Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
Reporting to you live from, in fact, the same house, but different rooms.
And I'm Quinlan Posner, and this is A Nightmare.
Yeah, let's get into the nightmare.
But never have I had such a beautiful backdrop.
This backdrop looks really good on you. Really good.
Soups profesh.
Soups profesh. Hold on. Let me test this. This is working. Okay.
I do want you to cut my hair.
All right, I can do it. Do you want me to cut it? Should we do it today?
Okay. Yeah.
I think I have an idea. I think I know what I'm going to do. Okay, so you tell everybody why you want me to cut your hair? Can you tell everybody about – okay, so for those
– because Carrie got a haircut.
Is that really why?
Oh.
Were you just inspired?
Oh, you mean the lice?
I mean the lice part two. I don't want – listen, Quinn has had a here's what happened. Last week we heard Quinn had truly like the worst start of school, the worst start of week, everything. We heard that a couple weeks ago. So after that call, the next day I had something I had to run by Quinn because, you know, you ask your friends for advice and you value their opinion, and Quinn's no different. I call her and I'm like, Quinn, do you have space to give me some advice? And Quinn's response was, yeah, I have COVID. I'm laughing because it's tragedy plus time is comedy.
It doesn't prevent me from giving advice, the COVID.
No.
But I did have it.
So you had COVID and I felt so bad because you were so sick. And then what happened?
But then I had lice.
Yes. And then you
got
lice.
Well, then I got lice. And then the kids had lice and I had lice. And I've done so many lice treatments in my hair that my scalp is so itchy from doing so many treatments that I think I still have lice.
Oh, my God. So you – like there's no way I can contract lice being here?
No. We would have to rub heads, so let's not. But
– I don't know. If you're asking me to cut your hair.
Lice don't climb out of your hair and they don't like jump or anything. But the way that it passes is like – for instance, with me and my kids, like we sleep together at night. So like our hair is touching all the time.
I'm excited. So I'm going to cut Quinn's hair today.
Yeah. Unrelated to the lice, I do just think it would be good to get a haircut.
I think it's going to be good to get a haircut. I'm going to get my practice.
And easier to treat, actually. Maybe it is related to lice.
Well, I also think, too, is I think because if your hair feels dry and gross, mm-hmm. is that how your hair is feeling? Because you've been doing all these lice treatments. Yeah. Let's get some conditioner.
Oh, for sure.
Let's do it up. Do you have a hair cutter? Do you have a trimmer, a scissor?
I have regular scissors.
Quinn, I wish I knew this. I would have brought my scissors.
These scissors are going to work.
Okay.
They cut things. Here's the thing about them. I cut Matt's hair with them.
Oh, okay.
And I cut the kids' hair with them. They work fine. They're not like kitchen scissors. They'll be fine.
They're not kitchen scissors? I thought they were kitchen scissors.
They've got a slim look to them that suggests – that although they're not for cutting hair, they wouldn't mind trying it. They're curious.
They're tri-curious scissors.
Yeah.
I chopped my hair off yesterday and it feels really good, feels exciting. I'm worried I look like a mom.
Oh, I always feel that way when I get a haircut, but I am a mom, so maybe it stings a little less.
It stings a little less. Me, I'm like trying not to be a mom for the moment, so I don't know. You know, it's just one of those things where you're like, oh, or do I look like a child? Like I called my mom today. She finally saw it, and she was like, you look so young. And I was like, oh, no, do I look like Madeline? You know what I mean? Like I toe the edge between like, mm-hmm. do I look like, I'm Madeline, and kids, eat your vegetables. You know, like, which one am I? And I want to be the hot one in the middle where it's like, wow, I'm chic and right. French.
Unfortunately, it is the same look. Like, really, what you're talking about, like, it's either way.
Yeah.
I think it depends what you're wearing. I think you've got to justify with Luke's. Or my friend used to get really short haircuts, and she was always like, when I get my hair cut this short, like pixie cuts, she would say, when I get my hair cut this short, I wear lipstick and big earrings because I'm like,
yeah,
I like it, but I like, I'm like, I need now to I want to balance the feminine card like harder.
It is amazing. And every time I get my hair cut, I have that moment where I'm like, it grows back, it grows back, it grows back, it grows back. You know what I mean? Like, there's always that moment of being like,
yeah,
it'll grow back. Because that's, and that's the other thing is like, I, there's something about hair that signifies the passage of time. God, I sound like I'm stoned, but I mean that, which is like when your hair, like, the, I've been growing my hair out for a long time and I've loved having like a little bit of a mermaid vibe, but I also just got so sick of like maintaining it and it was getting tangled and knotty. And I was like, you know what? Fuck this. Let's take weight off the bottom of my head and it'll be great.
My haircut is 90% based on lazy, which is to say I just don't cut it. But yeah,
I know that feeling.
Whenever I go get a haircut, I'm like, oh, fun. But I don't really get it. I have to be honest. Like, you pay so much money and then your hair only looks great for like 4 days.
I mean, my haircut then it just looks isn't bad too again. Expensive. I mean, I think also you do your own hair.
I don't. That's the part of it. If I did my hair, I could look great every day. But I who's going to do their hair?
Here's what I like, think actually you need to do. Are you taking suggestions at this point on hair?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
I think you just need to get like a leave-in conditioner and a styling cream.
Sounds like a lot of product.
It's two things. And the leave-in
You're talking to somebody that doesn't wash their fucking face.
Right. Right.
Do you know, like, I use water.
Well, Quinn, it's a vibe. It's an absolute vibe, and I love that for you. I put a little cream in the hair. I style it. I sometimes blow dry it. I mean, but I think you can get away. I think you have great hair. You have great hair. You don't do anything to it, and I think you have great hair. Thanks. There are people that do so much and don't have great hair. You have great hair. So there's that.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. By the way, you're listening to the hairstylings of Truly.
Truly. Darkly.
Creamply.
Creamply. I'm Quinlan Posner.
And I'm Carrie Ipama. And we have some Patreons to thank.
We do. The first Patreon I'd like to thank is Amy.
Amy, Amy, don't blame me for us, maybe. Amy, Amy, you are Amy. So.
Amy. Amy. Amy, you have to keep singing. I'm just doing the background. Okay. Amy. Amy. Amy, your song got particularly lamey. We couldn't figure out how to work together. It's because we're in the same house in separate rooms. Do you ever feel that about yourself? But more of a metaphor, I'm talking about life. Amy, Amy, will you be my wife?
Yeah, I think we can cut out the middle part and I think we have a song. The middle part where I got really confused part. Where that's I just heard you go, Amy, Amy, Amy. And I was like, I don't know.
I was being a background music.
Okay. I don't know if I would call that background music. I would say that's like a background creepy chant. But if that's the vibe, then that's the vibe here at Truly Darkly Creepy. Let's vibe. Okay.
The vibe's weird, y'all. And if you don't know that by now,
Quinn and I,
you're weird.
Quinn and I are doing a podcast swap and we listened to the ad that the other people want us to put in, which we will, and you'll hear it. And they're like, well, let's listen to ours.
Gotta re-record that. Like, we were like, whoa, we recorded that like week two. It sounds like shit. Why didn't you guys tell us? Really, I guess you guys aren't listening to it.
It sounds really, really bad. Okay, well, we'll record it later.
Speaking of things that sound bad, let's thank Lorraine.
Lorraine, Lorraine, it's because you're not a pain. Lorraine, you are so sunshiny in my face. Lorraine, Lorraine, you give us grace. Lorraine, Lorraine, keep up the
pain. You are our gain. You are our gain. You
What's funny is dear readers, you can't hear this because our microphones are going to pick up me, but hopefully I can hear Quinn a little bit.
Yeah, through the wall, for sure. I can hear you.
So funny.
It's alarming.
It's alarming.
I forgot to tell you that we had a pilot when we were flying last that was, it was like a Saturday Night Live sketch. He talked to us and walked us through every seatbelt sign off and on change that he made. Like an over talker, like would get on and be like, you guys, there's going to be a little bit of turbulence, maybe 6 minutes. It could be seven. It's going to start kind of crazy, but then even out. No. But at the same time, I feel like I need to turn on the seatbelt sign. So I'm going to, but then I'm hoping that I'll turn it off in like 7 minutes max. And then he'd get on at 7 minutes and be like, I'm going to leave it on like two more minutes. Then like he'd turn it off and then he'd get on and be like, it's going to be off, but it's only going to be off for 10 minutes. It's like a pretty bumpy ride and I just want to be safe. So in 10 minutes, I will turn it back on, but now's a good time to use the restroom. Obviously, the result is everyone's going to the bathroom in those 10 minutes. And then he's back on and he's like,
you guys got to get back to your seat.
I was wrong. It's only been eight, but I'm going to turn it on again. I'm feeling like it's going to get turbulent. And I was like, you are the most nervous pilot, which is not something I want in my pilot.
That's not a great review. I don't want a nervous pilot like I don't want a nervous gynecologist. There, I said it. You don't want someone who's operating heavy machinery. And yes, I described my vagina as heavy machinery because isn't it? It's like I don't want someone nervous operating my heavy machinery that I am working with or that I am riding. And this and you choose which one it is. It's
well said. Well said.
Or my business. You choose. I don't know which one is the one that I'm referring to. That being said, you know,
we got to jump into stories. You know why?
Oh, we have long ones. Let's go. You got to
go
first. We both have a long story.
I go first?
Mine's positive. Marco. Spoiler alert. So I guess you go first.
Okay. Yeah, that tracks. So I'm going to tell this under-researched story, even though I read like 9 New York Times articles. But when I Googled this story, I'm not kidding when I say I think 40 to 50 New York Times articles came up that were like, oh, all we did was write about this and we wrote about it every step of the way. And I was like, I'm not getting paid anymore to podcast. So I will pick 9 of your best articles and I'll have to call it a day and assume that I know everything, which I know is the kind of reporting you guys come to this particular podcast for. So I guess I'll really just credit the hell out of the New York Times, and maybe the most useful article was one by Robert D. McFadden and Frank Bruni. This is the story of Sante and Kenneth Kimes, and I could be saying their names wrong because I watched literally no videos about this. So I'm guessing. And how do you pronounce a name spelled Santa with an E? You know what I mean? Sante, right?
S-A-N-T-E?
Yeah.
Sante Dominus. That's from Sister Act.
Sante, I'm not confidante that I am saying your name correctly.
Is Sante going to be like Dante?
Spoiler alert, you are a bad guy, so I don't feel like it's a big deal.
His name is Sante, it rhymes with Dante, and let's go to the Inferno.
It's a lady.
Well, let's give her to the Inferno. That was some benevolent sexism. I just assumed the bad person was a guy. I hear. Who's in there?
Yeah, both my kids.
Matt. Both my kids.
All right.
Let's go.
It was good to see you guys. I'll see you after I'm done recording. I love you. Total rock star people.
Did they just sneak in?
Teamwork.
Did Matt try to block them like the Hurt Locker?
They came in to get something. They wanted some books that were in here, so it was fair.
I don't think they wanted to books. I think they were like, how can we interrupt? I think they wanted to interrupt you.
Household war.
What'd you say?
So I said, all is fair in love and household war. So this is a story about Sante. As we said, Sante Kimes and her son, Kenneth K. Kimes.
What's the last name? How do you spell the last name?
K-I-M-E-S.
Kimes. What a weird name.
Super weird. Kimes? That's why I feel so weird when I say these names, because I'm sure I'm saying them wrong. But here I go. Mm-hmm. Won't be the worst thing I've ever done. Trust me. So when Sante was 3 years old, her dad leaves the family. her mom has a bunch of kids and she becomes a sex worker to support them. Basically, she's bringing a lot of people in and out of the house, not supervised. Santa ends up being molested by several of them. And according to Santa's sister, she also had a sexual relationship with her brother. She also was somebody that liked to light a lot of fires. This is somebody growing up who had a really rough upbringing, and you're seeing it play out in behavior stuff. Mm-hmm. It's tale as old as time. She would also abuse animals. This is all I actually – this was not from any of the New York Times articles. This was all information I got from the Wikipedia page and was like, what? Because the New York Times stuff is more about what is going to happen with this case, and it's modern. But she would – they lived on a farm, and she would tie up goats and dogs and torture them. Then she's in high school, and her boyfriend is Edward Walker, who is a contractor. And while they end up getting married, and a bunch of homes that he was tasked with supervising and being a contractor for end up burning down. And if there's anything we know about Santa, it's she likes to play with matches. So I'm not pointing fingers. Neither did the court system. So we won't, but –
But did you – can you go – can you all read between the lines what Quinn is saying? Quinn's not going to say it. We're not saying it. Hey, we're not saying it, but we're going to pause.
It's a pregnant pause.
It's a pregnant – it's full of life, teeming with life in that pregnant pause.
But we're not at the pregnancy yet. We're at the affairs. So she's having a lot of affairs, and she's really interested in being with someone with money. She – like you know, her husband's Edward Walker, but like people with more money are hiring Edward Walker, and she's sleeping with those people. And she ends up finding this guy that owns a bunch of motels named Kenneth Keith Kimes, which is too many. His initials are KKK. So it's
I
think somebody should have noticed that and put a stop to it.
Unless they noticed it and liked it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, it's a good point.
That could have been the vibe too. Kenneth Keith, so terrible.
She reads about him in Millionaire Magazine and is like, this guy just got a divorce. And he's worth like 20 mil. I'm going to go find him. And she does. And she's a woman that gets what she wants. So now they together. And it doesn't matter that they're together in the sense that she was doing petty theft and all kinds of fraudulent things to make money before she meets and marries Kenneth. And then she meets and marries him and she's rich. And it is absolutely not going to stop. She does end up having a son, Kenneth Kimes Jr., and she's really protective in what I came to understand to be very negative ways, like sort of tyrannical ways where she's like, you're not going to be friends with these people. You're not going to go to school. She sort of isolates him, hires a lot of tutors. She picks everything he's going to wear and everything he's going to do. And at this time, as I said, she's still committing crimes. There was an accountant that worked for her that said that she was a bookkeeper for her for a couple of years. And when she met her, she'd say, I'm a crook. Don't trust me. Like, okay. She doesn't even try
she's not, to there's hide no, it. Yeah. It sounds like also she's dealing – there's like a lot of trauma stuff, man. There's a lot of trauma.
Totally. She and her husband and son were living in California, and then at some point they're going to move to Vegas. And when they move there, the first day they're living there, she steals their neighbor's watch. Like she goes into his house to use his phone or something, and she steals his watch. It's like she's not wasting any time.
No,
okay?
It's like every time she sees an opportunity to take something, like it's compulsory. Like she can't stop
herself.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, speaking of taking things, let's talk about taking people.
Oh,
I told
no.
you she had private tutors for him. And one of the things that happens is that one of these tutors comes forward to talk about how it goes down, which is basically she says that she would get taken to Mexico City and she would be told by her boss, Miss Kimes, to find teenage girls who didn't speak English, tell them that they had a job for them. And then take them back to the States and be like, now you're our maid. But then they would not pay them and they would abuse them.
And then these
were young girls that were taken from their families and didn't speak the language in a country they didn't understand. They had truly no idea what to do. But And this happened to 8
oh my
young
God.
Women.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Because I think she's like, this is working. And she, over years, take one, see how it goes, and then be like, this was one of my better ideas. Let's do this again. Let's have servants. Let's rock this.
Oh my God.
What ends up happening is one of them escapes from the house and goes to the neighbor and calls the police and explains all this. And they get the both the parents get arrested in 1985. And the charges are federal charges of slavery.
Yeah.
Beatings, abuse. So she goes to jail. The husband does not. It doesn't seem like he was part of this. You're sort of, I don't know the details.
He's
of
also
like
a millionaire. If
his
anybody,
involvement
he's
or non-involvement. Yeah. I just know that he didn't go to jail and she did. And that Kenny at the time, Kenny Jr., is 11 years old when his mom goes to jail. And she's in jail for 3 years. And during this time, he starts to get to live a normal life that he's never had. He's has friends and he's like going out and playing and he gets really close to his dad and he loves his dad. And his dad is like, I'm going to put a swimming pool in the yard for you and your friends. And I'm going to give you, I'm going to buy you a piano. I mean, he has a bunch of money. So he's just like spending it
it's
on Kenny.
It's crazy to me that this guy had a shit ton of money and yet he was still doing slavery.
Oh, it's so dark. Oh, I mean, but I God. Told you, it's about Sante and it's not about need. It's about want. So he doesn't talk to his mom while she's in jail at all. He doesn't miss her. He seems like he's like, I'm glad she's gone. His life feels like it reaches some element of normalcy during this time. And in 1988, he is done with grade school and he starts high school. He just has a normal beginning of high school where he's like, I like computers and sports and I date. And then 1 year later in 89, Sante gets released from prison and she comes out and she's like, you're switching schools. We're going to travel. We're going to do all the things I want to do. Pulls him away from the normalcy and they're going to Tokyo. They're going to Hawaii. They're going to the Bahamas. Here's your tutors. You don't get to have friends anymore. And they say that at one point when she was basically like, you're leaving school, he beat her up, like beat up his mom.
Whoa.
But he is very rageful at her, but has no recourse. The next year in 1990, there's a fire that destroys their home in Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
It is never officially declared arson. But what we since have reason to believe is that Sante had hired a 50-year-old lawyer named Elmer Ambrose to burn it down. Afterwards, she burns down his office because he had a bunch of paperwork that was related to this that she wanted to hide. And then they're going to bring that case to trial. And he tells his family, I'm going to Costa Rica with Sante and Kenneth. And then he just doesn't ever come home. Yes. And then he's never seen again.
Okay.
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 So now they're back in Vegas. People are watching like moving trucks move their furniture out of the house. And then later that week, she's calling the insurance company to be like, we were burglarized and they stole our furniture. She would do things like her son would be like, I want this computer. Great. And the first thing she would do was file a report that said she already owned it and it was stolen. So that she could just have it for free. Like it was, she's
how do
a wild
people,
card.
That's insane.
So they're, but like I'm telling you anecdotally things because there's obviously bigger fish to fry. People are disappearing. But at the same time, it's just wild that her way of life was this where like not a day goes by where some scam is not being perpetrated. And then something really horrible happens that will shape the rest of Kenneth Jr.'s life, which is that his dad dies in 1994. And we don't know much about that except that before he died, he transferred a bunch of land to his wife. After dying, Kenny enrolls to go to college in California. It's we just talked about when you have a really hard childhood, like he's starting to wear that on his sleeve. He's starting to, the police are getting called because he's threatening friends. He's beating up girlfriends. He's stealing stuff. Like it's not going great. He drops out And 2 years after his dad died and right after he drops out in 1996, we know that he and his mom tried to file some malpractice suits against a plastic surgeon. And both of those suits will get dismissed because they're not founded on anything. But it's the idea that the reason I'm telling you about it, even though it's a dead end, is that we think that's the first time he and mom start working together in a con artistry sort of way.
Right.
Later that year, they're staying in the Bahamas, and there is an officer of the first Cayman Bank on the Cayman Islands there named Saeed Bilal Ahmed. He has started to investigate irregularities in one of the bank's subsidiaries called Gulf Union Bank, which is in the Bahamas.
Okay.
And we have reason to believe they might have some money tied up in that bank. There might be some fishy things going on. They go up to him as the investigator and they're just like, hey, we actually are curious if you want to be a part of like an online business venture that we're starting. And he has an appointment to go to dinner with them. Mother and son. He does not ever return home. They go to the hotel he was staying at. His luggage is not there. They cannot find any trace of Mr. Ahmed. Okay?
Okay.
But obviously no lawsuits are filed at this time. And then their Vegas house burns down. It's like they have hobbies. It's very clear. So when they look at this Vegas house fire, they're looking to see whose name the house is under because she would do all kinds of things. She was constantly buying houses and putting them under different people's names. She's just trying to not ever have a record of all the nonsense she's up to. And this particular house was in the name Frank McCarran. This was a man that was in a homeless shelter that she had found. And they figure out that he's like, yeah, she kidnapped me basically, beat me up, made me memorize all these things to say if I was ever questioned. And they're like, whoa, that's not great. But whose name was it under before it was under your name? It was under this guy, Mr. David Kasdan. And David Kasdan had said he had never applied for a mortgage. They go to him and he's like, no, but I know that woman. I know Sante, and I've actually known her for 20 years, and I'm terrified of her.
Rightfully so, as you should be.
Well, sure, because the next thing that happens is they find him with a bullet in his head in a garbage bin near LAX.
Okay. There are people you don't want to meet. I just hope I never cross these. I just hope I never cross these people.
They're scamming their way into getting vehicles because their next plan, Kenny Jr. and Sante, is to go to New York, and they head to New York. They're using fake names. They're finding, they're bouncing checks to use cars, and they rent a $6,000 a month apartment.
What year is it?
The late 90s.
Oh, like, God, that's so – the late 90s, that's like $10,000 a month.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's totally nuts. And it's this house, it's an apartment in this big, I don't want to call it a boarding house, that gives the wrong idea, but it is this, it's a townhouse where this woman rents out sections of it, mm-hmm. Irene Silverman. And she's got this vibe of, I'm the host of the house. It's not like I'm your shitty landlord. Yeah. It's the vibe of, she hears that you have something to be happy about and a really nice bottle of champagne is going to show up in your kitchen that night.
Right.
She hears you have company and she's like, what kind of company do you need to borrow this china that I have?
Okay.
Like, make it nice. She's a make it nice. And people love her. She's an institution in New York and she was a ballerina when she was younger. And she's this person that gardens all the time and she loves this house. She just sounds like a classy broad. She is now missing. She disappeared on July 5th.
Oh, my God.
And you would think that they just go get them for that, but actually they go get mother and son because of all the car nonsense, all the bounced checks and using cars, and they find them at the plaza, and they arrest them. And in the hotel, they go through a gym bag they had and they see that there's a deed that was transferring ownership of that house on 65th
to
Street
them?
To them, from Irene to them. They also find a gun in the bag, a 22 caliber handgun. They find some shitty like Halloween store handcuffs that they bought, a bunch of passports, a bunch of driver's licenses, just like fake fraudulent shit. And they're like, this is bigger than these cars. We know that a witness that day that Irene disappeared said that they saw her having a fight with Kenny Jr. And this was at 10:30 in the morning. And then she went to go get in the elevator to go up to their apartment. And she told her maid, go walk the dog on the roof. And then the next thing that happened is no one sees her. Kenny calls the maid and is like, you got to clean my suite. And she's like, no. Because she probably was like, I saw you fighting with Irene. Yeah. I'm not going to do shit. And then he was like, well, whatever. Get the dog out of here. And you're like, what? Creepy. When the news that they might be responsible for this woman's death, because it's just a bridge too far at this point, and it's popping up on the news and they are suspects, all the people that know them, that know Kenny, are like really surprised because their vibe is, whoa, he hates his mom. Like, he's always hated her. He's always felt like she made his life worse. And he wasn't the kind of guy that was into doing crime. It's just so weird that after his dad died, it's like everything fell apart and he just went to her and became this pawn of hers. Like, just became her right-hand man suddenly. It's like he gave up on his own life and he couldn't get away from her. And they just keep saying, like, it must have been all these combined factors that pushed him over the edge.
Ugh.
So then we get to the trial and they walk in holding hands and the judge is like,
what? No, that's weird.
Don't do that.
Don't do
that. And people are like, yeah, they were sharing a bed. Like, we don't know. Oh, we know God. That she has a background in some incest stuff. We just don't know. We don't. Now, keep in mind, there's no body. There's no eyewitness. There's no forensic evidence. What do they have? What they have is they found 14 notebooks of notes that Sante kept that have all kinds of weird shit, like I gotta buy leg irons. And you're like, why? And she wrote down things like it's her to-do list. And she wrote down things like get social security number, get keys, get signature, get checks. Then she wrote things like, when goes to sleep? ? Blood type. What kind of movies does she like? Any exits in her apartment? Is there a burglar alarm in her apartment? Does she have help there on weekends? And then there's another list that says, get Lincoln, which was the getaway car, practice, and park close. So they're like, it's just a list of how they decided to murder this woman and try to take this building from her. And the trial is a total wackadoo shit show. Both of them, very bad behavior, mother and son. They're yelling at their lawyers. They're yelling at the cops. They're making crazy statements about how it's a conspiracy against them. At one point, Sante is saying that she thinks the judge is using secret hand signals to talk to the prosecutors. And then she says at one point, the only murderers in this case are the prosecutors for murdering our Constitution.
I thought she was – and the only murderers in this building. And then you turn into like it being only murders in the building. Damn.
Yeah. Oh, God. So many murders. It is like murders in the building where you're like, everywhere you guys go, there seems to be a murder.
Yeah.
But instead of hosting a podcast, it seems it's like
they're
you just
doing it. Yeah, they're the murderers.
Committed them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The judge is like, you are a sociopath and your son – I love this. Your son is a vacuous dupe. So he calls
– he's like, you guys – vacuous dupe is so good.
He's like, you guys are a no for me, guilty on 118 counts, including murder, burglary, robbery, sentenced to 125 years. This is in the year 2000 that this happens. Okay?
Oh, no.
Now
– it's more. There's more.
October, later that year in October – oh, God, of course it's more. Later that year in October – Maria Zone is a freelance producer for a docuseries called Crime Stories. And she goes to the Clinton Correctional Facility to interview Kenny Jr. And they're taking a break from the interview and she turns and he grabs her and pushes a pen against her neck and holds her hostage. And he's like, everybody back off. There's an officer that pulls an alarm. A bunch of other people, negotiators come. And he's like, my main thing is I don't want my mom to be extradited to California. And they're like, okay, well, let's talk. And then they wrestle him to the ground and get her away. So nothing comes of this, but...
That's so scary. Could you imagine us, like, a true crime? Like, we're... That's insane.
Very crazy.
But I bet the episode was killer. I bet the episode was very good.
Then the trial of the murder of David Kisdin is going to happen in June of 2004. In this trial, strangely enough, before we even get to whether they killed Kenny Jr., in this trial is like, I do want to talk about how I did definitely kill Irene Silverman. What happened is we walked into a room, my mom turned on the TV and she had a stun gun and she hit her in the head with it. And then she told me to do it and I strangled her. Then we put her in a garbage bin in Hoboken. And so this now, 4 years later, it's like, yes, I did kill Irene. And now they're both going to get convicted of killing David Kasdan.
Which one was David Kasdan?
He's the one that they found with a bullet hole in his head, right. Also in a garbage bin. Okay.
Yeah.
And also shot with a .22 caliber.
The guy that had the mortgage in his name.
Yes, that's correct. So many people they killed, it's hard to keep track. Yeah. She dies in prison at 79 after being there for like 10 years. And she was serving time for both those murders, right? Irene and David's. But I'm going to backtrack to talk about the other crimes and just tell you that in the year 2000, Kenny Jr. was like, oh, Holmgren? We did kill that guy. What happened is that my mom hit him in the head with a hammer while she was in the back seat and he was in the front passenger seat. Do you remember him?
No.
Graham was the lawyer that she's supposedly hired to burn
down the house.
Her house in Hawaii, and then burnt his office. And then he was going to go to Costa Rica with her. And he never returned. So now, in 2,000 years later, Kenny Jr. saying,
"Now in 2,000 years later, now in
2,000 years later, they never die." Is the other really scary part of this? They're vampires,
and that's the thing: is you want benevolent vampires, you don't want evil vampires like these guys.
This isn't what you want.
This is not ideal.
They're not friends with what you do in the dark or whatever.
What we do in the shadows. So you're on today. The lice. I'm worried about this lice medication.
They went in my ear and ate my brain. He also confesses to murdering 46-year-old banker Saeed Ahmed, who, remember, was
in the Caymans. Yeah, he was
in,
like,
charge of her offshore bank accounts and was investigating them and then disappeared in the Bahamas. He said that they drugged him and drowned him in a bathtub and dumped his body offshore.
It's weird but that they don't have a modus operandi. Like, it's interesting that they have different tactics.
That's what's wild. It's like they killed that guy with a hammer. They shoot people. It feels really sloppy. And just speaking about how they have, no clear pattern. Another thing that I read, not in New York Times, but on Wikipedia, so whatever, grain of salt, but could be, is that in 1995, there was an abduction of a 62-year-old woman named Mary Jacqueline Levitz. She was the heiress to the Levitz furniture fortune. And people saw her buying wallpaper for her house, and then she just disappeared. And then later, somebody came to her home, and the door was just open, and there was a bunch of blood everywhere and signs of a struggle, like really scary signs, like broken fingernails, very freaky. And people say that there was things about that case that they felt like it could have been Sante behind it. Mm. They were never charged, but they were also never charged in Ahmed. There was never a trial for that, which seems really bizarre.
Well,
and I'm not sure,
sure
why that's
because
true
it was in the Bahamas.
When he's like, we did that.
Well, yeah, but it was in the Bahamas. They would have to extradite him. And I don't think the U.S. is going
to
let him leave to go to another country.
Oh, right. Because they just kill people everywhere too. Well, I mean, it's a very absolutely insane series of events. And I did want to let you know that Irene Silverman, ballerina turned gardener, turned home most amazing landlord, turned murdered. She did leave her house to the Kobe Foundation, which is a nonprofit charity she had established in her life to honor the work of her mom, who was an embroiderer, and others in that field. I also wanted to tell you that if you want to hear how these names are really pronounced or watch a TV show about it, I read that there's two biopics and that one of them is starring Mary Tyler Moore.
Whoa. So,
do your research, folks. I didn't. And see if you want to watch one of those and tell me how to say all these names I just mispronounced for an hour.
It's just so funny to me, too, that like it does remind me a little bit of Robert Durst in a way, because I think Robert Durst, I don't think, is a mastermind.
Yes, but you're enough.
But enough. But again, what got them in the end is the financial crimes. It's not the murder.
And the idea that it's a rich person.
Yeah.
That their greed and their status keeps leading them, but they're a sociopath, so they're
it sounds like she's a sociopath. I mean,
they have enough because they don't need things. They need to feel like they got one over on somebody. They need to be in control, and they're so sad inside that they're like feeding a bottomless black hole, and they're feeding it with pain and bodies, and it's so scary.
I mean, this is a serial killer. They say the number one motive for female serial killers is financial. For men, number one is sex. And I think this is very, and it's very, I mean, the like Oedipal thing, the like, the trauma of her youth, totally like, you know, I was obviously in the show called Psychology of Serial Killers. So I learned a little bit about the psychology of serial killers based on Dr. Rachel Toll's analysis. And it does sound like all the things of her youth fit the profile of a serial killer in the making.
It's super spooks.
Super spooks. That's wild.
That's the scientific term for it. Mm-hmm. And I told
super spooks. And you told it. That's great. Thank you for telling that story. Also, I will have nightmares about that story. Okay. I'm going to do a little bit more of a positive story. And I wish I could give a little bit suspense, but I think the suspense is built in. I got this from the New York Times. It was an article called Speck in the Sea by Paul Tuff. That's all that I got it, because that's all I needed. I want to introduce you to John Aldridge. He is 45 years old, and he and his best friend from childhood, Anthony Sosinski, they're two lobster boat fishermen off of Long Island. They've been besties for like two decades. They've been fishermen for about two decades, but they've been besties since grade school. John is this like quiet, intense, determined, hardworking guy. And both of them are hardworking, to be clear. And then Anthony is this class clown guy. He has like long blonde surfer hair. He rides a unicycle, but he's known for being like loud. So it feels kind of like a fun friendship dynamic. You have like the quiet one, the funny one. And in 2006, the two of them had the opportunity to buy their own lobster boat called the Anna Mary. And they pulled their money together. And they started this business together, and they have about 800 traps off of Long Island. And two times a week, they go out and they pull 18-hour shifts picking up their lobster and selling them. But like lobster fishermen, it's a fucking grueling job. You get out there, you have to pick up the traps. You know, there's a lot of work involved, right? So it's 18 hours. So they set out for one of their weekly rounds on July 23rd, 2013, and they set out with their deckhand. They hired this guy, Mike Migliaccio, to help them. And so what they would do typically is the two of them would take shifts, right? So like one person would sleep, the other person would keep watch in the beginning, especially when they're going out very far to where their lobster traps are placed. And the two of them worked very well in sync. And so what happened was it's about 9 p.m. that night. And John is like, hey, Mike, Anthony, you guys go sleep in the bunk. I'm going to wake you up at 11:30. Or that's when Anthony was like, wake me up at 11:30 and I'll take the next shift. So it's like 3 hour shifts. They're divvying it up. It feels like at this point, based on what I read, it seems like they're both pretty in sync and have this system down pat, right? And so it is 11:30 and John is like, you know what? I'm feeling pretty good. I'm feeling awake. I can maintain this a little bit longer. And so he's like, I'm going to let my friends sleep. They can wake up and take it over, blah, blah, blah. So he's like starting to prepare for the lobsters. So they're about 40 miles off of the tip of Long Island, and it's around 3:30, 3-ish in the morning. And so what John needs to do is he needs to start pumping water into the holding tanks so that it can get very cold. So by the time in the morning when they get their first traps, they can stick the lobsters in there and they'll stay cool. So the lobsters will be alive for their return back to shore, right? So he's getting to the tanks. He has to open this metal hatch on the deck. And I think there's two on each side. So I think he gets one opened or something, but he goes to the other hatch. And unfortunately, the hatch is covered by these two 35-gallon Coleman coolers. So they're like the plastic insulated coolers. And when the coolers are full, they are like 200 pounds. So they're quite heavy. The only way he can get them to move without waking up his friends is to snag a box hook into the bottom of the plastic handle and then take it with both hands and lean and pull with all of his might, right? Mm-hmm. And so he's like, I could do this, no problem. So he like does that. He puts the box hook in, he grabs hold, he like leans really hard, and the plastic handle snaps off. Now he's pulling with all of his might, right? His back is to the back of the boat. And what's important to note about lobster boats is that there's not a back on them. They're just like a straight ramp into the water. It's a 45-foot long boat or something, but like it's a long ramp just straight into the water, right? So he pulls, the plastic handle snaps. His friends are asleep downstairs.
And he's like rolling down the ramp.
He like stumbles. And the boat is on autopilot, okay? So the boat is going, he's stumbling, he's like trying to grab, and he goes to grab the edge of the boat, and his hand misses it by inches, and he, boom, lands in the ocean.
And the boat's like beating it.
The boat is going like, I don't know how many fucking knots. It's 6.5 knots. I don't care. Bottom line,
but
the boat's fucking
like, bye.
Cruising, you know, pun intended. So
his friends are asleep on a boat that's driving away from him. He's like yelling, nobody
it's
can hear
3:30 in the morning. So he's like yelling with all of his might. He's in his like full fisherman outfit. He's yelling with all of his might, but the motor is so fucking loud that they don't hear him. And why would they? They're also under the deck. So he's like, okay, shit. And so he's like, starts to panic a little, but he's like, okay, don't panic. And then he has this like fleeting thought. This is how I die. Because keep in mind, he does not have a life jacket. So he's like, gotta
stay positive. Wear a life jacket, folks.
I mean, this is his job. I mean, I think again, like, yeah, you gotta wear a life jacket for sure. But he's done this thousands of times, right? Like he's been at this. This is 2013. He bought the boat in 2006. This is 7 years, right? What's just like so crazy is he's supposed to wake up his friend at 11:30 and it's 3:30 in the morning. So the first thing you're supposed to do when you land in the water is you're supposed to kick off your boots because they're really heavy and they can weigh you down. But he notices as he's treading water that the boots are sort of like pushing his legs up, like it's almost floating in a
like
weird
buoyant.
Way.
Yeah.
And his boots were something that's interesting because his boots were a bit of like the object of ridicule by his friends because they were these like big, green, clunky boots that kept your feet warm in minus 58 degrees. And it never gets that cold on Long Island. And so he's like, okay, I have this idea. So he kicks his boots off and he takes one up and he like dunks it topside down. So it has like a boot air bubble in it. And he tucks it one under his armpit and it stays afloat. Nice. He kicks his other boot off. He puts it down. He tucks under his armpit. He stays afloat. So he has like two floats, which is great for someone without a flotation device. But he also knows it's 3:30 in the morning and he has about 2 hours until sunrise. In the first hour, he's like floating, just like figuring out what to do. The second hour, he notices two shark fins circling him less than 10 feet away. He clocks them. He sees that they're blue sharks. They're about 350 pounds. He does have a buck knife on him. So he like gets it out and he's like ready to attack. Or like if they come at him, he's like ready to stab him.
Shark fight.
But they swim away. Nice. He has a lot of time to think about his life. And he thinks about his family. He thinks about who's going to go and find his dog. He thinks about the funeral at the church. He thinks about his family. And his family is not which is not common. His family doesn't come from like a long line of fishermen, which I think is common when you're in this line of work. It's like something that you're taught in a lot of ways. And he flashes to this conversation he had with his sister not long ago where he told her, because she was like, I'm really worried about you. Like what you're doing is dangerous. And he says, you know, if I ever get into trouble out there, just know that I'm going to do everything I can to get back home. It's 5:30 in the morning. The sun rises. He is tired. He is thirsty. He has been awake for 24 hours. So it's finally some daylight. And so he's like, okay, I can like maybe make a plan. I can figure out what's going on. So he wants to find a buoy so that he could be easier to spot. So he's like looking, the waves are crashing up. When he's going on a crest, he can like see out and he finally sees a buoy, but it's against the current. So he like starts trying to go. Now he has these flotation devices, but he is like, he takes a sock off. He puts it over his hand to try to give him more pull, to give him more sort of, you know, to move. But he finds that he's just absolutely exhausting himself. And he's like, this is not worth it. I'm getting fucking tired. So then he's like, I'm just going to chill. He spots another buoy. Unfortunately, it's with the current. So he's able to swim there. And he gets this buoy, but it's not the sort of like safe bastion he wanted it to be. He was hoping he could kind of like grab on and hold. But this buoy is really big. It's a couple of feet around. And so he like can't get comfortable on it. You know, like he can't actually like reach.
It's too big a ball.
It's too big a ball. Yeah. And what's really hard is these buoys are connected to lobster traps at the bottom. So what's happening is like when the water waves come, because as you can probably imagine, the line is not getting any longer, right? When the swell comes and he's on it, he's being sunk with the water. He's going underwater. He's getting more and more tired. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, he's been up for over 24 hours. So he's like, okay, what am I going to do? He's like, okay, I'm going to cut it and I'm going to tie it around my wrist and I'm going to see what I can do. So he starts like, I'm going to try to find another buoy. He goes and he swims to that other buoy, and this is around, I think, like 9 o'clock in the – no, maybe 9 o'clock in the morning. I mean, I don't know if we know what time he gets to the other buoy, but he does end up finding another buoy, and he takes the buoy that he had like on his hand, on his wrist as like a way, and he connects the rope from one buoy to the other, and so he can straddle the rope in between two buoys. So he's like, okay, he doesn't have to tread water. He still has his flotation device. He's like, his thighs are rubbed raw from this buoy, from this rope. But he's like, okay, maybe I'll be easier to spot. Meanwhile, let's go back in time to 6 o'clock in the morning. Keep in mind, Anthony and Mike were supposed to be woken up at 11:30 in the morning. It is 6 a.m. Mike wakes up first and he goes upstairs and he's like, John is nowhere to be found. So he calls for Anthony, right? He's the hired hand. He's like, Anthony, do you know where John is? And Anthony's like, no, but it's a flat boat. Like there's not a lot of places for someone to hide. They're 15 miles past their traps and they're almost 60 miles offshore. They look everywhere. He's nowhere to be found. At one point they see the hatch cover is off and he's worried that he hit his head and fell down into the open lobster tank and drowned. And so Anthony remembers like looking in being like, oh my God, am I about to see my dead friend? Obviously he's not there. At 6:22 in the morning, he calls for help. His voice is shaking and Anthony says, Coast Guard, this is Anna Mary. We've got a man overboard. The Coast Guard for this area that covers this is based in New Haven. And as soon as they get this Mayday call, they hop into action. They get the details. They find out, no, John wasn't wearing a life vest. No, he doesn't have a GPS distress beacon. He didn't leave a note, right? They're like, did he just kill himself? Like, there was no note. They're like, yes, he can swim. So they have this survival simulator where they can input the information they have, which John is 5'9", he's 150 pounds. And with the water, the temperature that it is, they say he has about 19 hours of survival, especially without a flotation device. And that's even pushing it. 6:28, there's an urgent broadcast. It says, this is United States Coast Guard Sector, Long Island Sound. The Coast Guard has received a report of a man overboard off the fishing vessel Anna Mary, south of Montauk, between 5 and 60 miles offshore. All mariners are requested to keep a sharp lookout. Now, keep in mind, they don't know when he fell over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The guys went down to sleep at 9 o'clock in the evening. It wasn't discovered he was gone until 6 a.m.
and a half hours later. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He fell 6 and a half hours later. But the time in which they don't know is between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m.
Yeah, huge.
It is massive. And keep in mind, when you land in the water, you're not just sitting there waiting. The current is dragging you. So even if you, like, for how many hours, we don't know where he is. They have no fucking clue. Mm-hmm. The Coast Guard has been using rescue simulations since the 70s. But they've been using this one system, SAROPS, S-A-R-O-P-S. So they start to like put in this information in SAROPS. And they're like, okay, because – so this is where they first go. Anthony is like, he was supposed to wake us up at 11:30 at night. So he must have fallen between 9 and 11:30 p.m. So they put all this information in SAROPS and they start to get a search perimeter. Now keep in mind, they don't know he fell off actually 4 hours later. Mm-hmm. So the good news is the day that they're searching, it's great weather. It's clear. It's sunny. They have some good weather to look. But they put all the search assets in place and then they send everybody out. You know, they're like, here's the big search area. Go and find him. Let's go. Now, he fell, like I said, at 3:30 in the morning. So at this point, the area that they're searching for him is 30 miles south. Or no, is 30 miles north from where he is. So there's no way they're going to find him, but they don't know that, right? People are just like going into action. So at this point, Anthony is in the boat just waiting, trying to find his best friend. And he's able to take stock of what's happening in the area and get clues from what time he fell off the boat. So he's able to see that one of the hatch covers was upside down on the deck, which every mariner knows is bad luck. An upside down hatch cover means your boat is going to wind up upside down. So he must have left it propped up against the side when he opened the hatch, and he wouldn't have left it there for too long. He also noticed that the lobster holding tank pumps are on, and he knows John was probably preparing them for the day, and there's a specific time of day that he would prepare them. And then he notices the broken handle on the ice chest, and he realizes that's how he fell overboard. And so he says, you know what? It wasn't making sense with the 11 p.m. call. So they have now a new theory. Meanwhile, the Coast Guard has called John's parents and they're flipping their shit. I think in a very like, I don't love to paint in broad strokes, or maybe I do. I don't know. But his parents get the call from the Coast Guard and his dad's like, I think my son's dead. His mom is like, I'm very hopeful. News of John travels back to his peers all on the harbor and people spring into action. One boat who was taking customers to go fishing ended up dropping his customers off, refilling his boat, and joining the search. In an interesting anecdote, Jimmy Buffett had hired like a big fisherman to take him out. And when he heard about this Mayday call about man overboard, Jimmy Buffett was like, hey, I agree. Let's go join the search. So Jimmy Buffett's really nice boat that joins the search. All in all, 21 commercial boats volunteer to look for John at this point. And usually when Good Samaritans join the search, the Coast Guard declines. It just gets a little messy, a little too much. But the search area was so big and vast that they're like, you know what? We'll take any help we can get. And they put Anthony in charge. So he's manning the search effort from his fishing boat for his best friend. Meanwhile, John has been in the water for almost 9 hours. In fact, he recalls seeing helicopters that are a mile away from him, and there's no way they're going to see him. And he realizes very quickly that the Coast Guard thinks he's drifting, not knowing he has a buoy. So he feels his energy depleting. He is getting burned and he's hopefully waiting. At one point, he sees the Anna Mary, his boat, a quarter of a mile away from him. And he screams with all of his might, but they don't see him and they turn away. And he's like, it was the second time of day that I saw my boat leaving. So fucking scary. So obviously they have helicopters going at the same time. And with their new search parameters, people are searching an area, I think, closer to him. But again, the ocean's quite large, pretty hard area to search. So one of the helicopters is going. It's been searching since 7 o'clock in the morning, and it's 2:19 p.m. And the helicopter is an hour from bingo fuel. And what bingo fuel means is that they have enough gas to get home. That's bingo fuel. Once you hit bingo fuel, you have to go home and refuel. However, if they were to go home and refuel, they would be in a fatigue state, or they'd be in a fatigue status. And so the Coast Guard would not let them take off until the next day because they had like already hit their allotted flight time. And if that was the case, if they came back, they wouldn't have left for the next day, which would have put them past the 19-hour survival window. So
got it.
At this time.
So they're like, let's fly till we straight run out of gas.
Yeah. And at this time, okay. The plane search and rescue computer system crashes. It was overloaded with all the input. So the helicopter is reaching out to search and rescue being like, what path do you want us to take? And they're like, you know what? You're close to bingo fuel. The system crashed. You got to come back. And they were like, no, we still have some fuel. We should try something. And so they compromise and like you can do one last route. And it was a random path. Like apparently a guy just like looked at coordinates based on what he had last saw and was like, okay, go here. And they didn't even like – it wasn't even like – go this way. They're like, here's the manual coordinates that you can put into your autopilot. And so they put in the coordinates manually into their autopilot. And at 2:46, they start moving. 12 minutes into their search, they hear mark, mark, mark. And unlike before when they ran into Mylar balloons or sea turtles, this one, the guy searching was fucking full voice. He sees their guy. They find John Aldridge in between two buoys. They go down, they grab him, they put him on a rescue basket. He sees his boots, beloved boots, life-saving boots float away, and he yells at them to grab him. They grab them, they put him in the basket.
He's like, Wilson.
Very Wilson, exactly. They bring him up, they cover him in blankets. They radio Anthony, his best friend, Anna Mary, we have your man. He's alive.
Nice.
They take him to the hospital. He is treated for hypothermia, dehydration, and exposure. In the weeks following this, a reporter talks to local fishermen in a local bar and on the harbor. And while they talk about it, they say they admit that they cried when he was found. And in fact, they would these like big burly men are tearing up again, recounting this story. John Aldridge says he has no PTSD, he has no nightmares, no flashbacks, no fear of going back to work. It's like business is normal for him. However, the people around him, I think, feel the stress even more so.
Everyone's in life jackets.
Everybody's just terrified. Like they almost lost this guy, right? Yeah. A few weeks after his dad got a tattoo on his arm of a pair of big green fishing boots and in between him, the GPS coordinates where his son was found.
Oh, I love that.
And very sweet. And his best friend.
That's a good tattoo. I'm going to get it too.
And his best friend, Anthony, is shaken up still to this day. He says, more than anything, I think about it when I'm out there working. He explained, it was the whole feeling of helplessness. Something was torn out of me. And that part just doesn't show back up. But the two of them went back to work and continue as lobster fishermen. I don't know if they're still doing that now. This article was from 2014. But it's like one man's – I think this like John was just like, I'm going to fight like hell and I'm going to stay positive and I'm gonna get back home. I'm going to do my damned best. And it feels like a lot of luck and, yeah, a lot of vigilant people.
Wow. Thanks for telling that happy one. That's great.
Isn't that a crazy story?
Yeah, I love it.
I love a little happy story. It was
I love lobster.
There's
I love boats,
even more details.
I love fishermen. I love survival.
There's even more details that were some fun anecdotes. Like just something you should know about Anthony is Anthony was a fisherman and I think he had two kids. And one day he came back from fishing or from being on the water and his wife disappeared with his two kids. And she wasn't picking up his phone. And he fought to get his kids back and he won custody of his two kids. And he talks about going to PTA meetings and being on a boat so he can be home at night to be with his kids. And, you know, these guys are just, they're really, they're best friends. And yeah, I just, there was a lot of really lovely.
And there's a biopic of this and Mary Tyler Moore plays Anthony.
No, she plays John. Just Mary Tyler Moore out in the water with the boots under her pits. With her capris, obviously iconic capris. Wow. So yeah, that's the story of A Speck in the Sea by Paul Tough. Please read it. It's fucking incredible.
Love. Great. Thank you.
Welcome. All right. Should we go? I actually have a crazy – okay. I know we're probably going to release the September TTC Teeny Tiny Creepily, which I don't know how tiny it's going to be. My story's long. Oh, Quinn, big yawn. That being said, I'm really excited and nervous to tell you the story for TTC because it's fucking dark. This has stayed with me in a way that I'm like, I think I have to have it be a TTC because it's too much. I can't shake it. So let's go record that. Hey, dearest readers, we love you.
Love you guys.
Bye, dear readers.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.